Excuse me, can I have everyone's attention, please? We want to get this started in a few minutes. As usual, please turn off your mobile phones, ship-to-shore radios, the rest of it. We're getting pretty busy here at the FCC. We've got two more events this week. On Wednesday, Barry Wayne, well-known to all of you, I'm sure, will be talking about Mahathir's legacy in Malaysia. And on Thursday, Paul Midler, the author of Poorly Made in China, talking about manufacturing quality across the border. I'm very happy to welcome Cameron Duick, a former South China Morning Post and Financial Times colleague of mine, to the FCC today. He really does have a fabulous story to tell, and I know a lot of people here today were also here last March when he spoke about his then upcoming voyage through the Northwest Passage. I just want to tell you a little bit, a very brief story about my own obsession with Cameron's trip. It's easy to live vicariously through someone like Cameron when you commute to a cubicle in Central every day. Late last summer, when Cameron was about halfway through his Northwest Passage, David Lee at the Bank of East Asia was hosting a small lunch for journalists. Reg Chua from the South China Morning Post was there, also Mary Kissel from the Journal and a few others. We were talking about the Japanese parliamentary elections, which were about to happen or just happened, when out of the blue, Mr. Lee turned to me and he asked, "Do you think Cameron's going to make it?" I was really stunned because I'd been reading Cameron's blog about his voyage that very morning, and I had absolutely no idea that one of Hong Kong's most prominent businessmen had also taken an interest in his adventure. So I stammered. I said, "Well, it's really interesting that you asked. They're in a bad patch of ice right now, but if they can get through it, they should be fine. If not, they may have to leave the boat in Cambridge Bay or Goa Haven through the winter," and so on. It was at this point that I noticed that there was a really stunned silence around Mr. Lee's lunch table. And that's when I realized that his question had really been, in its full context, "In next year's UK parliamentary election, do you think that David Cameron, leader of the Tories, is going to make it as prime minister?" And he addressed it to me because I was the only journalist there who works for a UK paper. At which point I got on my tap dancing shoes and tried to explain my way out of that one. I told them they were going to laugh when I explained this tangent I had gone on, but they didn't. And I haven't been invited back to David Lee's lunch table since. Anyway, that's how obsessed I was with Cameron's Northwest Passage, which I did, in fact, follow daily through the summer on his excellent website, openpassageexpedition.com. And if you didn't do that, it's still up there and just a remarkable diary of a remarkable adventure. More seriously, let me say that when a colleague of yours, no matter how accomplished a sailor he is, tells you that he is planning to sail the Northwest Passage, your initial reaction is, "Yeah, sure you are." Then you notice that every time you go over to talk to him about a story, that he's alt-tabbing between Arctic websites and, in fact, not doing very much FT editing. Then he takes a few weeks off to go buy a boat in Vancouver. Then he's holding a launch party for his website at a small flat in Sai Ying Pun, which he's mortgaged. And you notice the walls are covered with maritime maps of the Arctic, or at least the few that exist. And then you think, "Wow, he's really going to do it." And he did. And I can tell you, just from watching the process as his colleague, that his pursuit of this adventure from start to finish is really one of the most impressive things I've ever seen. So eat your heart out, Tim Severin. And Cameron, thanks for coming to the FCC today.
So do you have David Lee's number? Because I'm going to probably need some sponsorship for the next project, and now that he knows about me. Thank you very much for being here today. I do recognize a lot of faces from when I was here before I left. And I hope that the story today is going to be a little different than then. Then it was a lot of, marketing talk, really, wasn't it? A lot of plans, and now I have a bit of a story to tell. I want to open up by talking a little bit about the Northwest Passage and the history of it. Here in Hong Kong, when I've been talking about the Northwest Passage when I was planning to do this, I got a lot of blank looks from people. It's very, very far away from Hong Kong. In Canada, the Northwest Passage is something that comes up in discussion quite often. It's a very important issue regarding sovereignty, regarding climate change, regarding how Canada deals with Aboriginal people. And it's an important link in Canada's history. And when you look at this chart here, this is our course. That red line doesn't look very long up here, but I can tell you it's a lot longer when you sail it. The Northwest Passage kind of begins where you see the word Russia, the Arctic Circle in the west, and ends where the Arctic Circle crosses Davis Strait in the east. And it's about 4,000 nautical miles. And for anybody that hasn't kind of read anything about the Northwest Passage, this is a very important sea link between the Atlantic and the Pacific. And it's something that hundreds of men have died trying to find. And it was only sailed for the first time in 1906. And even now, there's a lot of discussion about shipping through the Northwest Passage, a little bit fanciful, I think, but it remains a very, very hot kind of topic as far as climate change impacting commerce and trade, because this is one place where you can see how climate change is really impacting life, because this area used to be covered by ice, and now in summertime there's open water, and that means that ships can go where they couldn't go before, and that means that communities that were isolated are no longer as isolated as they were. So that's the background story, and that's why this place appealed to me so much. When I started thinking about this project, the idea came to me in 2004, actually, off the coast of Brazil. I was delivering a yacht from South Africa to the Caribbean, and it was probably 30, 35 degrees. We were off the coast of Brazil, you know, sizzling on a white deck, and I don't know how I started thinking about Arctic sailing at that point, but I started thinking about where I could go, where I could sail, and where I could sail where there's an interesting story. And that's really sums up how I approached this project, was that I was looking for both a place that was a sailing challenge, a sporting challenge, but also a place that had an interesting aspect for me as a journalist. And the Arctic, the Canadian Arctic and the Northwest Passage certainly delivered that. Our goals were two main goals. One was to sail the passage end to end without any assistance and bring back the boat and crew in one piece. And without assistance is an important point, because there have been an increasing number of yachts that have done it in recent years. In history, before we left in spring, about 36 private yachts had done it. And that doesn't sound like a lot. It's less than probably people have climbed Everest. But last year, there was 10 private yachts went through, which is a new record. However, every year, quite a few of those require the assistance of a Canadian Coast Guard icebreaker to get them out of a tough spot. We didn't, and that was one of our goals. We would do that, we would sail through, and we did not want to have to request assistance. The second goal was to sail through the Arctic and hear the story of how climate change was impacting Canadian Arctic communities. And there are a lot of scientists studying climate change. When you're in the Arctic in the summertime, they're hiding behind every blade of grass, it seems. They're everywhere, you know, measuring, studying, and it's very important they do so, and they're doing very important work. But they don't really tell the story of the people, and they don't tell the story of how climate change is impacting people's lives. Because this is a place where climate change, this is the front line of climate change, and when you want to look at how climate change is impacting human lives. And that was a story that we wanted to tell. We wanted to hear it, learn about it, record it, and then tell it to people when we came back. So those were our two goals. And that's what we set off to do. You can't do something like this alone. And this was the crew that I rallied. There was initially a woman named Anna that joined us for a month, and she dropped out after a month. I'm not sure it was the sailing or the smell of three unwashed men on a 40-foot yacht, but she decided that she'd had enough. Dr. Tobias Neuberger is the man right next to me. He was a German medical doctor and amateur photographer and a very good cook when it comes to cooking on a boat in a storm. And next to him is Drew Fellman, who's a LA-based IMAX movie producer and photographer and a friend of a friend. And he came up and joined us and replaced Anna for 1 month. And at the end is Hans Bergmann. He's a professional sailor, also a German, and he was the saving grace of the expedition, really, because he was much more experienced than me and much more level-headed than me. And there was many times when I needed to focus on doing journalistic things, and he could kind of take the helm and look after the boat and things like that, and that was very important. And he also set the rather conservative tone of the expedition, because when you're going into the Arctic, you want to do things as safe as you can. You don't want too much excitement if you can help it, and because usually excitement ends up leading to trouble. And Hans, when we were in Victoria, I think it was my father was speaking to him, and Hans said, "I don't want any adventure. I don't want this to be an adventure." And which was shocking to me, because I was really off. I was looking for a rollicking adventure. And he was there to kind of keep things under control, and he did, and was much appreciated. I think it's important when you're talking about a project like this to kind of talk a little bit about how you get to doing it. Tom mentioned some of it, and it's interesting that when I was planning this, I had some people come up to me and say, "Man, you're really lucky. You must have saved up some dough. You know, you can quit your job, go off and do this. Lucky you. You're single. You got no kids. All this sort of thing," and all true. But it still takes an awful lot of sacrifice and an awful lot of kind of risk taking. And for me, when we actually got to the point of leaving, I felt at that point that I had achieved everything I kind of needed to achieve to get it done, because it was very difficult. Because this was during the financial crisis, if you remember, and trying to raise funding. I have no background in adventuring, so going to sponsors and saying, "I'm planning to sail an old boat through the Arctic, do you want to back me?" Was pretty hard sell. In the end, I think that some of them probably regret they didn't, because we got incredible international coverage and we delivered very well for our sponsors, but at the time it was a very hard sell and budget was very, very tight. So I went out and bought a 30-year-old 40-foot fiberglass sailing boat. Anybody that knows anything about sailing in ice, fiberglass is not the best choice. But budget meant that a 40-foot steel boat was out of my range. And this picture here shows us in the boatyard a week before departure, grinding down the fiberglass and applying Kevlar to the hull to strengthen it. That's my 80-year-old father standing there. He knows nothing about boats, but it didn't stop him from coming out to the West Coast to give advice. And I wasn't a particularly happy man at this point, because I was under extreme stress trying to pay the bills, keep the crew motivated, and trying to keep it all together. I remember my hair was actually falling out in clumps. That was not an excuse for this, but my hair was actually falling out in clumps from stress at that point, because it just, I didn't know how we were going to make this happen. And so it was very, very tight going right to the end, right the last week, trying to get the boat ready, trying to get the crew ready. We were still installing electronics at this point, ordering new sails. It was complete madness. But we made it. June 6, 2009, we sailed away from the dock in Victoria. And we had the bagpipes playing, and a lot of family and friends came out from around the world to see us off. And my family was very emotional, and they were very emotional again when they saw us arrive in Halifax. And you know, I didn't understand quite why. I mean, I'm setting off on a big adventure, and I'm the youngest in the family, and they're kind of getting used to this sort of thing with me. But they are not sailors. I grew up in the Canadian prairies. I didn't grow up in a sailing family. And they didn't know anything about sailing, and they really thought that they might never see me again. And I felt really bad afterwards, because I guess I hadn't quite clarified that I wouldn't take a risk like this unless I was confident that I could deliver on it. So off we went, and everybody was waving and, you know, saying their goodbyes, and little did they know that we went around the corner and dropped anchor about 5 miles away, and cooked a big dinner and slept for 12 hours, got up, made a big breakfast, and then said, "Right, okay, now let's go to the Arctic." Because we were all so knackered from the preparations. Now, sailing through the Northwest Passage brings a lot of risk and challenges, and some of them are very obvious, like the ice. But the ice is, you learn a lot about the ice when you're in the middle of it and trying to keep a 40-foot fiberglass boat afloat. And that is that, as a sailor, you're always worried about the wind. Where's the wind coming from? What's the strength? What's it forecasted to do tomorrow? But when you're in the ice, you're not only worried about the wind because of propulsion and where you can sail and what angles you can sail, but also because it blows the ice around. And the tide, it moves the ice around as well. So we would get satellite imagery of where the ice was, how thick it was, how what concentration it was. And usually that information was null and void by the time we got it because the ice had moved, the wind had blown it around. So you're always second guessing the forecast, comparing ice charts with wind forecasts, trying to figure out where the ice is going to move. And it makes for very, very stressful sailing. And this was a very low year for ice again. I think it was something like the third year in a row where the passage was basically open. And it was the third lowest year in the third year average for ice. So really a very little ice in the passage. But as you can see, we still got very close. We hit ice several times. I'm embarrassed to say that almost every time we hit ice, I was at the helm. I'll tell you, there's no faster way of getting your crew up on deck than hitting a piece of ice. It's like being inside a drum and somebody beating on it. It was very, very loud down below when we'd hit a piece of ice, and you get some very worried looks coming up the companionway. So the ice is a constant challenge, and because also, even though we have radar, it doesn't pick up ice of this size. If the ice is only a meter or two above the waves, it really doesn't pick it up. And so you really have to watch very, very carefully, and that's very difficult in the dark or in fog. The other aspect is timing. And it ties into the ice issue as well, but even though the Arctic summer, I mean, it starts in late June, goes through till early September, for much of the early summer, the Inuit hunters still travel on the ice with snowmobiles. So obviously you can't sail through on a yacht. And it's only in late July, early August, when the summer heat has been working long enough to actually break the ice up. So then it's only a few weeks until the winter freeze-up starts again. And so you only have a very, very narrow window to get through the Northwest Passage. And that's something that was on my mind the entire time. You have this tick-tock of the ice clock in your head. And we entered the Arctic. We were one of the first boats into the Arctic this summer. And we were, I think, the last boat out. So we tried maximizing our time in the Arctic because we wanted to visit as many communities as we could. But every day that we extended our stay was, you know, pushing it a little bit and risking that in the end we wouldn't get out, or that we'd get really clobbered by storms coming out. Navigationally, sailing in the Arctic is a nightmare like nothing I've ever seen before. I thought the worst was when I sailed the Red Sea and marking the entry into a harbor, and I think it was in, I'm not sure if it was in Egypt or Eritrea or something. It was marking the entry into a harbor was a stick in a sand bank with a Coke can on it. And that marked entry into a major harbor. Well, that we would have been very happy for that in the Arctic. A lot of the charts have depth based on data that was collected, 100 years ago. Because there's just not that much sailing up there. There's not much traffic up there. So the government does not maintain updated charts, really. Added to that is the fact that your GPS is hugely inaccurate. We had an instance where we sailed into a very, very narrow bay one night. It was more like going into a fjord and trying to get some shelter. It was storming. We'd been at sea for 5 days. We were tired. We wanted to have a night's sleep. And we came in, and it was dark. It was at the end of the summer. It was probably beginning of September sometime. And we came in, and I was using the radar and the chart plotter using the GPS navigation to find out where we could come into this bay. And it was a very narrow bay, maybe 100 meters wide. And in the middle of it was a massive rock, which was awash at high tide. And so we came in, and I was looking at the chart plotter and trying to measure with the radar and figure out where the cliffs were, because you couldn't see the cliffs. It was just pitch black. There was no moon. And we managed to drop anchor and everything, and I woke up the next morning. We're getting ready to go, and I fired up the GPS system and fired up the charting system, all this electronic equipment, and looked at where it put us. And 12 hours after we dropped anchor, the GPS system was putting us about 200 meters ashore, which I was quite confident we weren't, because I was on the boat and we were afloat. But I shuddered when I saw that, because I realized that if our GPS had been so far out the night before, we would have probably run into the cliffs. And this was just simply because there's so few satellites that give proper coverage of the Arctic that getting your position is very dodgy. And so navigation is a real challenge. And the depths are off. We were always watching our depth sounder. And even though we had a very close eye on our depth sounder, I intentionally mounted it very near the helm so the helmsman could always look at it. We still ran aground several times. And it's just a real, real nightmare. Add to that the challenge of there's no support in the Arctic, really, for yachting. I mean, for obvious reasons. In the last 100 years, there's been about 45 yachts come through. It's not exactly a business model, is there? So I spent a lot of time in this position, hanging into the bilge of the boat, working on the engine, doing regular maintenance or doing repairs. At one point, our entire diesel engine broke off all of its four of its mounts. Anybody that has worked with boats knows that that's bad trouble because the engine vibrates and you can end up putting a hole in your hull with your shaft if it breaks. We were very lucky, but we had to then repair it in the Arctic and re-drill, re-tap. It was a complete nightmare. And the thing is that when you come into these communities, some of the communities are quite big, you know, 1,500 people, some of them. Most of them, a few hundred people. But they don't have marine parts. They don't have boat parts. They use outboard engines on aluminum boats. That's it. So they didn't have gear for a sailing boat. So we ended up carrying a lot of just raw materials like sheets of rubber, cable, sail material, you know, just all this kind of stuff that we could fashion stuff out of, steel, flat sheet steel. And we ended up having to do that quite a bit and just fashion parts as we could to repair the equipment. And while you're doing all this, you have to live on board. So not only were we sailing and keeping the boat going and navigating and taking pictures of walruses on the ice, and every community we'd get to going ashore and shooting film and shooting photos and doing interviews and trying to get a sense of what's happening in the place, but you also have to do dishes and cook. Even the captain has to. Life at sea takes quite a bit of time, especially for someone like me who's been living in Hong Kong. And, you know, you can pop down and get some noodles real quick if you don't have time to cook, but not when you're on a boat in the Arctic. So, you know, we had to cook three times a day. You have to have haircuts at sea. And another thing that we did, had to happen was deck showers. We had fresh water, but when you're at sea for a long time and you're not sure when the next port of call will be, it's rather unwise to use your fresh water for bathing. So we would use the seawater for bathing, and the seawater temperature was anywhere from +4, +5 down to zero, because salt water doesn't freeze at zero. Other things do freeze at zero, I'll tell you that. So we'd stand on the foredeck of this boat under sail, at an angle, slippery, naked, watching ice floes go by, and with a bucket pouring water over your head and trying not to whimper. It was very refreshing, though, I have to say. But I did often, when I'd stand up on deck and before I put that first bucket of water on my head, I'd do a quick last check. Do I smell that? Do I have to do that? Yeah, do I have to do this? And usually the rest of the crew would say, yes, you do. But as I mentioned, our goal was much more than just to sail the passage. Our goal was to learn about climate change in the Arctic, and that meant meeting people. We were very keen on hearing people's stories, not talking just to scientists, not just to experts, but just everyday people and getting their perceptions of what's happening. This was in Wales, Alaska, one of our first sort of stops in an Inuit community. And they told us a story that we ended up hearing again and again and again all summer, which was about how the ice has become so unpredictable. And it's very dangerous as a hunter to go out on ice that you can't read. And they've been doing this for generations. They have they have a wealth of knowledge of how to look at a piece of ice and tell you, is it strong? How many years old is it? Where does it come from? Will it hold the weight of a snowmobile? But they said climate change is changing all that. And all our traditional knowledge is becoming useless because the weather is changing so fast. The freezing and thawing patterns are irregular. And there's stories of deaths in the Arctic of hunters that were very experienced in going out and being caught in conditions that were very unusual. And they spoke about that a lot. They also spoke a lot about species of animals coming north that they don't normally see. These guys in particular told us about sea otters off the beach in Wales, Alaska. That is in the middle of the Bering Strait. They said, we don't have sea otters here. Never seen a sea otter before. They said, this spring, we saw a sea otter off our beach. I go, what's he doing up here? And it's interesting to have them. You know, they're cute. The kids might like them, but that changes the whole balance of the ecosystem if you have species moving north. And when you're relying on these on this wildlife for your food, that becomes very, very worrying. This woman told us about berry picking. She said that her berry picking season had moved up by one whole month in the last 4 years. Now, this is an inexact science or inexact information, isn't it? Well, you know, could have had, you know, could have been warmer, just a bit warmer, or more sunshine those few years. But I thought it was very important to hear their stories because I wanted to find out how climate change is impacting human communities. And fear and perception is a very important part of that. And they're having to adjust their lives, the way they are planning, because they're afraid of what they're seeing around them. And she was talking about this berry picking and how they would go out, and used to be in early July, and now it was in early August. Used to be in early August, now it would be early July, when this certain berry was ripe on the tundra. We also learned a lot about how climate change is tied into the culture of the Inuit people. This is in a place called Ulahaktuk. They're skinning some seals. And the women that were skinning these seals started talking to us about what seals meant to their culture and what traditional food meant to their culture. And getting back to this talk about, you know, the berries and the food that's on the land and on the ice, the Inuit really rely on this food for their livelihood. Because food is so ferociously expensive if you buy it in a store. And it's also very tied into their culture. In hunting and eating these foods and preparing these foods and then tied into their language and all these sort of things. And so if climate change is impacting wildlife, it impacts their lives, it impacts their culture because they rely on this culture. These animals are such a huge part of their culture. And the story of food, of the tundra being their grocery store, we heard that term many times where hunters would say, well, this is my grocery store. This is where I go for food. We kind of kept a milk index, we called it, on the boat, checking the price of milk in different towns. And it peaked out at around $22 Canadian for a 4-liter jug. That's about four times as expensive as it would be in a major Canadian city. And that those prices sort of ran through the store. And so if you can't hunt, if you can't get enough food for your family out on the land, you end up paying prices like that. And it's very, very hard to sustain a proper living. We went out on a caribou hunt with a few Inuit hunters one day, and it was very interesting because it illustrated the tie between hunting and culture in a way that came home for me, because we'd been in a lot of communities where there was a lot of problems with the families, where a lot of the families had broken up. There was a lot of socioeconomic problems, which I'll touch on in a bit, but it was very hard to find kind of a happy family that was together and kids that were happy and well and stuff. And so we went out on this hunt, and after the hunt, the hunters invited us to their home to eat some of the caribou with them. And it was really interesting because we shot two caribou, and as you can see, they're fairly big. They said that this meat will be gone in about 3 days. And I could very quickly understand why, because as soon as the word got out that they had shot two caribou, everybody was coming to the door. All the friends, relatives, you know, distant relatives, neighbors, they all came over for some caribou. And it was a very welcome thing. This is the way it was supposed to be done. And you really saw how the hunt and the caribou kind of helped reunite these families, even though they live modern lives. I mean, they're not living in igloos. They're living in, you know, proper houses. They drive ATVs, four-wheel drive trucks. They have mobile phones. But it was something that they could actually come together for, whereas they were still struggling with a lot of socioeconomic problems that were tearing them apart. And that was really interesting to see. And we ended up spending a whole evening with them. And the hunt then started bringing out stories about their strength contests. And they started showing us all these different things they do in the Inuit Olympics and the games and the string games and all these different things. We spent the whole evening there. And it was midnight by the time we left. And we really felt that, well, this was an instance where we saw modern Inuit culture in reality and being acted out, and they were very sincere, speaking the native language in Nooktitut and English, and the kids were well adjusted, and this was a hunting family that took hunting very seriously, and they really said that hunting was what kept them together. Going back to the what I mentioned about socioeconomic issues, drug and alcohol abuse is rampant throughout the Arctic. And we would often be anchored or tied up to a dock, and there'd be kids running around at 4 or 5 in the morning, little like kids this age, like kids that should be in bed. And because domestic violence is so prevalent that a lot of these kids don't really have homes to go to. And which was a very sad story, but then you looked at the entire community, you can see this playing out through the entire community. Education is in shambles. Because kids have no reason to stay in school. There's no economic development, really. And so therefore, they're very interested in having, these kids were not affected by alcohol syndrome, but others were. But the you speak to a lot of people, and they would talk about economic development, like oil drilling, natural resources, and this was a blessing. Down here, we talk about oil exploration in the Arctic, and we say, no, you shouldn't do that. But if you spoke to them, they're like, yeah, bring it on, because we need the jobs. We need jobs for our kids. And every town was sort of, this was quite a typical Inuit town, Arctic town. They're not terribly cheery places. They're really, you know, you go in there and you can see how these kids become very despondent and depressed and don't see a future for themselves. And all of these things obviously are tied to climate change, because with climate change you can do more exploration in the Arctic, and you can harvest some of these. You can access oil reserves that were very expensive to access earlier, and this can bring money and jobs into a community and give them a reason to continue existing. So that brought us to Pond Inlet, which is on the between Greenland and Baffin Island there, and that was kind of at the end of our summer. That was beginning of September, but we still had 2,500 miles to sail to get home. And just to give you an idea of what 2,500 nautical miles is, sailing from Hong Kong to the Philippines is a popular pastime here. There's an annual race. This is what, about four of those trips, I guess, to the Philippines, and in much rougher, colder, wetter conditions. And so off we went, and we had a lot of storms coming home. For a lot of the summer, we lacked wind. We wanted more wind for sailing. But on the way home, we had basically a month solid of gales, 8-meter waves, and it came to a point where we were off the coast of Baffin Island, and we got hit by a wave. I was down below on the chart table, and I got thrown clear across the boat. The boat is 12 feet wide. I got thrown clear across. I don't think my feet touched, and whacked my head on the other side, suffered a concussion. And so Tobias and Hans had to steer us home. Drew had flown home by then, and Tobias and Hans had to steer us home. And also on the way home, we discovered that we had got trichinosis, contracted trichinosis in the Arctic from eating raw, or not raw, undercooked grizzly bear. Somebody had given us grizzly bear meat. We accepted it gladly, and we barbecued some grizzly bear steaks, which were delicious, and then made grizzly bolognese, which was equally delicious. But I think it was probably the steaks that got us. We didn't cook them quite well enough, and this parasite started affecting us, caused a lot of cramping, fevers, headaches, loss of strength, loss of energy. But we continued on and worked our way through the Gulf of St. Lawrence, saw a lot of whales on the way down, and finally came sailing into Halifax on October 10th. It was bucketing down with rain. We probably had about 30 people on the dock from around the world, Hong Kong, Germany, across Canada. People had come to welcome us home, and we were very pleased to make it and toast to the expedition. And we did achieve our two goals, which was to sail the passage without assistance and bring the crew home and the boat home in one piece. And we did learn an awful lot about climate change in Arctic communities, and we're still in the act of sharing it with people like you. So thank you very much.
Cameron, thanks very much for a fascinating tour of the adventure. I think most people here know that we normally try and wrap up bang on 2:00. However, I'm happy to let this run over a bit. But that said, if you do need to get back to your office, don't be shy about getting up and going. let's just throw it open to the floor straight off. Let me. I should have also said that, you know, Cameron, as a result of this voyage, he's recently been welcomed into the Explorers Club, quite a prestigious New York club. You don't get into that club by hiking Timeless On or anything. Any questions from the floor? He was also a guest of the World Wildlife Foundation at the Copenhagen Summit, much in demand there. In the back corner, please. And please just tell us who you are.
I'm Gary Smith. I run Saffron Cruises, but we just cruise around Hong Kong. I actually did last year the San Fernando race, so I know a little bit about racing. But for a journey of this size, you had diesel engines on board, and where you were visiting was mainly outboard, which had two-stroke. So, and you had to motor a lot. Did you have fuel problems, and how did you manage the fuel situation?
Yeah, we did have a diesel engine, 48 horsepower diesel engine. All these communities burn diesel for heating. And a lot of these communities have sizable fleets of trucks, snow plows, things like this. So there was always diesel supplies. I shouldn't say always diesel supplies. Some communities we had trouble getting diesel because the seasonal barge had not come in yet to deliver. There's one barge a year that brings the diesel in. But we had a very large tank. We had a 1,000-liter tankage for a 40-foot boat, which is quite big by normal standards. And so we managed to find diesel. And I should mention, the entire expedition was made carbon neutral through carbon offset credits. So we measured how much diesel we were using, and we offset the entire amount. Anybody else?
Peter Bozar, semi-retired advertising executive. You know what that means. Quick question. What was the make of your boat? And also, what was the shift system you employed between eating, sleeping, helming?
The boat was a 40-foot cutter rig sloop made by Fred Amore. It's a small, very small boat yard on the west coast of Canada. He built about 26 out of this mold, and very full keel, very very heavy, 17-ton boat for 40 feet, which is very very heavy. And the shift system, we went a 3 hours on, 6 hour off. Anna, even though she was on for a month, she never got up to speed on sailing. And Drew, when he came on, I decided at that point we were so used to having a three-man system that it was better to have him shooting film, shooting photos, and cooking delicious meals, and we would take care of the sailing. So you'd be on for 3 hours, no auto helm, so you had to hand helm the whole time, and solo watches, and so 3 hours on, 6 hours off. And then you always had a lazy watch, and as captain, I obviously did a lot of lazy watches, so I ended up sleeping very little.
Cameron, I know you Canadians are very insecure about not being American, and very, very jealous in terms of protecting your sovereignty in the Arctic. Could you just tell the audience a bit about your encounter with the Canadian Coast Guard?
Yeah.
When you entered Canadian waters.
Yeah, I think I know what the story you're after. Canadian Coast Guard, first of all, was spectacular to us. They were professional, friendly, and very helpful, and kept in touch with us. Before I went to the Arctic, I registered with something called NORDREG, which is a registry, a marine maritime registry for the Arctic. And the Canadian government has introduced it a few years ago as a voluntary system to monitor traffic going through the Northwest Passage. And this is sort of one of the Canadian government's ways of showing that they are the administrators of the Arctic, and therefore the Northwest Passage should remain Canadian waters and not international waters. And that's a big debate that's going on. The U.S. wants the Northwest Passage to become international waters. Canada wants it to remain internal waters. So I registered with NORDREG. I mean, as a small yacht, I was quite happy to know that there'd be somebody kind of watching us. And when I did that, I pointed them to our website, which had a live tracking. 24 hours a day, you could see exactly where we were. I gave them all the information on contacting us. And so we were checking in with NORDREG every 24 hours, giving our position. What happened was we sailed into Tuktoyaktuk, was our first Canadian port, major Canadian port. Again, big town of over 1,000 people. And when we arrived, there was another yacht tied up that arrived just hours before us. We asked them, where do you guys clear in? clear the boat in. You have to, when you're sailing into a country on a yacht, you have to clear the yacht in through customs. You have to clear the whole crew in through immigration, and it's a rather casual affair, but there's a lot of sort of paperwork to do. And they said, "Oh, just go up to the RCMP office. They're really friendly. They're really fast. It's really easy." I'm like, "Great." So we went up there and showed all our papers, and I showed all the ship's documents, and I'm a fairly new yacht owner, so I was being a little bit. I had all my papers lined up and all the insurance documents and lined them all up for them. And I said, "There you go." And the RCMP, I'm not sure what his position was, but he had the most gray hair. And he came over and he kind of looked at the papers and he looked at them kind of oddly and, yeah, that's fine. And he said, "Tell your foreign crew to come in and show, I want to see them with their passports." And okay. And he waved us on our way. So we thought, well, we're cleared in. And I thought it was odd he didn't take my port clearance from the previous port, which is standard. That he should take that, but he didn't want it. And I was like, well, maybe it's different in Canada, who knows. And off we went. And our next stop was Sachs Harbor on Banks Island, which is a community of 150 people on an island that's probably half as big as Europe. I don't know, it's huge. And we were in this community, and it started snowing. It was it was in the first week of August, and it was our first snowstorm. And we were walking down the road, and suddenly this RCMP truck pulled up. And the guys are very friendly, and they said, well, they handed me a note. They said, immigration in Inuvik is trying to reach you. Inuvik is sort of the main administrative center for Western Canadian Arctic. And so I found a phone, gave him a call, and they said, yes, the U.S. Navy has told us that there is a boat heading towards Canadian waters, and we haven't had anybody check in. And RCMP reported that there is a strange boat in harbor in Sachs Harbor, and we're wondering if that's you. And I said, well, yeah, we were in Canada and we were in Alaska, so it's probably us, yeah. And I said, but I checked in with Tuktoyaktuk. I've been reporting in with NORDRAG, which is controlled by the Canadian Coast Guard, every 24 hours, and we had physically met Canadian Coast Guard and spoken to him on the radio on numerous occasions by that point. So I didn't feel that we were exactly hiding. And he was kind of accusing me of trying to get into the country without announcing myself. And short of it was that we ended up, the RCMP in Tuktoyaktuk had no idea what he was talking about. He didn't understand what this meant, that there was a yacht coming into the country and wanting to clear into the country. And the short of it is that we should have called Inuvik to clear in, but the RCMP didn't know that. So bringing this all back to sovereignty, Canada is trying to maintain its sovereignty in the Arctic and the Northwest Passage. They have a lot of increasing number of personnel, Coast Guard, RCMP, all these sort of things. They're lovely people, very professional, but they don't talk to each other. And there's obviously a little bit of a missing link there.
Any other questions from the floor? Annette in the back corner and then in front. Sorry, in the back corner first, Simon. We'll come back to Sonny.
Yeah, hi, Cameron. Annette Johnson with Finance Asia. I just wanted to ask, knowing what you do now and with the same budget constraints, is there something you would have done differently, except perhaps have your boat ready more than 2.5 minutes before you set off?
I would have bought there's some equipment issues I would have done differently. Minor equipment issues that I might have bought a different model or a bigger model or... But no, I think that in general, really what it comes down to when you're up there is if you have the wits about you to come up with a solution, because you can never take every spare part you're going to need. You can't. You'd sink your boat if you did. And we already took a lot of spare gear, and more than a lot of other people did. We took a complete medical kit. Tobias could have, you know, amputated my leg without having to call emergency. And we carried oxygen and all this sort of stuff. And I think if I had the same budget and had to do it again, I would do it much the same way. Yeah. And take much the same crew.
Question here. Just while the microphone's moving, what was the total budget for this, including the sponsorship?
It was well under $250,000 US. Just under $250,000 US.
Cameron, it begs a question. I mean, assuming you don't want to return to the FT and do a desk job editing
No one's asked me yet.
Philippine company news. It begs the question, what next and where next?
Well, I'm working on the book right now. writing a book about the summer. Also doing a children's book, an illustrated children's book about the journey. We're also doing a TV documentary. So I've got my hands full for the next little while working on these sort of things, and I'm also trying to do some freelance, if anybody's looking for a freelancer, just to pay the bills in the meantime. And going around talking, doing as many speaking engagements as I can. You're asking if there's going to be another expedition. I learned so much doing this that I sort of feel that it would be a little bit of a waste if I didn't plan something again. But I don't think it'll happen before 2011.
Question in the back, please.
As I understand it, you chose. Sorry, my name's Mike Paul. As I hear it, you chose to hand steer the boat, and you didn't use auto helm. Can you just say why that was?
Yeah.
And secondly, if you're interested in doing the China Sea Race at Easter, I'm still looking for a crew.
Ah. Excellent, because my racing boat authority just told me on Friday that they weren't going to do it, so we must talk to each other. Hand steering. I installed a heading compass with the whole system. It's the boat's ready to go to put in an autopilot, but the nature of the kind of waters we were sailing in for most of it, I didn't want, because I knew we were going to be doing solo watches, I didn't want a case where one of my crew went down to go to the head and make a cup of tea and come back up 5 minutes later and because of the ice, the horrible charting in the Arctic. Usually you're worrying about these things because of traffic, but I was concerned about this in the Arctic because I knew the charting was off, the ice was going to be there. So I just decided, we were tight on budget and I could see we could cut from the budget there, and it was something I didn't want to be using in the Arctic anyway. So I had everything set up to put autopilot in with the navigation system. It was all talk to each other, but I ended up not putting it in just because it saved me money and I realized we'd probably be better off without it. Anyone else?
Again, in the far back, and we'll come over here. And please don't be shy about rushing back to the office if you have to.
Cameron, my name's Ross Mitchell. You talked about going up there and hoping to get through the Northwest Passage. What was plan B?
I had done research on a few different ports where you can leave the boat. Cambridge Bay. There's a few choke points when you're going through the Northwest Passage. Let me just go back to a chart of the passage here. There's a few choke points, and you kind of have to think of places where you could leave the boat in all those cases. One of the first ones is when you come up to Point Barrow in Barrow, Alaska. It's a very, very tough spot. Sorry about that. I'll get this down in a second. There we go. Okay. So in Barrow, Alaska, that's a tough spot right there. There's a lot of ice that comes into shore there. If you get caught there, you basically have to go all the way back into southern Alaska somewhere to find a decent port. Barrow is an extremely unprotected spot. The other place is between Victoria Island, where you see Cambridge Bay, in the middle of the chart. That's another spot where there's a big problem with ice. Cambridge Bay is then your refuge. The Coast Guard has many times in the past escorted yachts to Cambridge Bay. Joe Haven is another spot where you can leave the boat. After that, I mean, if you make it through Joe Haven, we went through Bellot Strait, which before we went through it, only 9 yachts ever in history have ever made it through there. And we managed to make it through there. And after that, once we were through Bellot Strait, we were pretty much home free. So, yeah, there are a few places you can leave the boat for the winter. Obviously not ideal, because then you have to fly the entire crew out and bring people back in and winterize the boat in the Arctic. But there were a few places where we could leave it. We had to.
Looking at the chart, is it possible to go north of Banks Island, straight over to Pond Islet, and also are there any points along this journey where an icebreaker can't get to you?
It is possible to go north, and that is when people talk about shipping through the Northwest Passage, that's actually the route they're talking about. We took the classic sort of southern route, and if you go north above Banks Island, there's much deeper, clearer water up there. But the problem is that there's more ice up there because it's further north, so it very rarely opens up. And so when they're talking about the future, bringing tankers through, that's more what they're looking at. Sorry, what was your second question?
Any place icebreakers couldn't have got you out?
Not really, no. I mean, the Canadian Coast Guard knows their way around. They don't generally go through Bellot Strait very often. But no, we generally stayed in the, we stayed in pretty often. The area, the waters we sailed through were pretty common waters to sail through up there. The only change we made was from Tuktoyaktuk, we went up to Sachs Harbor and then out to Ulahaktuk because there was a lot of ice hugging the shoreline, so that it was kind of to the south of us. And it ended up being, we kind of gambled, and it ended up being a brilliant gamble because the other boats got stuck in the ice. And we went north, and it was exactly opposite of what normally happens, because normally the ice moves north, and you can sneak along the south side, kind of just hugging the northern coast of North America. And we instead went north. And this year, you know, had nothing, you know, we were looking at it, and it looked like it was open, so we thought we'd try. And we ended up going the other way, and for some reason this year, the conditions switched over from what they normally are, so we ended up getting through. And actually, some of the boats that were stuck, we were in radio contact with them over long-distance radio or medium-frequency radio, and we told them, come up through this way, come up where we are, because there's open water. There was two other boats that were trying to get through. And by the time they got up there, it was solid ice, and they spent a couple of extra days stuck where we had just sailed through, you know, literally hours before. So.
I think this will have to be the last question, please.
My name's Sue Thornton. Where is your boat now?
Silent Sound is in Halifax. She's for sale. I'm very keen to sell her if I can. I have some bills to pay off. And yeah, she's in near Halifax, Mahone Bay to be exact. And if I can't sell her, I'll be forced to sail her over here, which would be awful because there's the Caribbean you have to get through.
But you're also a little sad to be selling her.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. We have a gift for Cameron, as we always do. We have some charts of the Magellan Strait for his kayak adventure. He probably hasn't told you that, Jackie. but please join me in thanking Cameron for a fascinating talk. Oh, yes, of course.